originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Sabre wins the Derby for Todd Fletcher.
Basalt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna and Jude Feld.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. It is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, Jude Feld, Pontiff of the Pick Four. We are together in our Jimmy John's of Lexington broadcast studios and happy to have you with us for the next hour on Sirius 219 XM Channel 206 and all of you tuning in worldwide with our live streaming on your computer or your mobile device at horseracingradio.net. JT, another fun trainer talk lined up here for tonight. I had a chance to make a trip to Canada this past week for the Sovereign Awards, and this is where I came up with the idea of tonight's guest. Going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, really looking forward to it. He's lucky enough to ply his trade at Woodbine, a track that we love and a very enjoyable place to race and visit. So it's going to be fun to learn about his life and what goes on north of the border.
Well, tonight's guest was born June 8th, 1964 in Toronto. He learned about racing, believe it or not, by reading Blood Horse magazines, which his father subscribed to. He now finds himself the trainer of 759 winners, including multiple graded stakes winners. He is trainer Mike DiPaolo, who joins us now on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Mike, welcome, my friend.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Yeah, happy to have you on board. And, you know, you think about last year. We'll start with some recent history, considering the fact that we just referenced the Sovereign Awards. You came one win shy of equaling your most wins in a season, which occurred the year before in 2015, but you racked up the most purse earnings of any year in your career, in large part to four graded stakes winners that you trained last year, and then, of course, the brilliant three-year-old filly Karen, who was named champion three-year-old filly and horse of the year at the Sovereign Awards last week. So well done.
Yeah, we had a real good year. It's going to be hard to top, but we're going to give it a try.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. What do you do for an encore?
Well, we've got some young babies. You're always hoping that you make the right draft choices, you know?
Yeah, that's always important, and it can be nerve-wracking, but it's also like Christmas sometimes.
Yeah, I can remember like a horse like No Holding Back Bear. I walked down the shed one day, and I had come back from Florida, and I said, wow, who is that? And it was a horse that Dan Dion, they had bought as a short yearling. And as soon as I saw him, I said, man, this is a good-looking horse, and he certainly turned out to be.
Yeah, he ends up being voted champion sprinter. So not only do you train the horse of the year, the champion three-year-old filly, but you train the champion sprinter as well. And then you were up for finalist for outstanding trainer, which makes a lot of sense, and you were in a pretty tough field. You were in there with Roger Atfield, Mark Cassie, and Greg Tracy. I imagine that's just an honor to be nominated in that category.
Yeah, I mean, you almost feel like you win because Cassie's kind of in a different league, you know? He went two Breeders' Cups. He's tough. But the cool thing, No Holding Back Bear also finished second in the voting for Horse of the Year, so that's pretty cool, being first and second.
Yeah, that's a nice exacta, and wow, you train two champions and you don't go away with the chrome. That's a little heartbreaking.
Yeah, well, you know what? My old boss used to tell me, can you take that to Longo's? Longo's is like a supermarket here, so he'd be like, can you take that to Publix? There's no check involved, so it doesn't matter that much.
That's right.
But I mean, hey, we'd love to have won it.
Mike, let me ask you this question. You're sitting there in that room, and I don't know, maybe there was 400, 500 people. I was there because we were nominated in the media category, and we were one of three finalists. So we went through, earlier in the evening, we went through the same thing you did as you were waiting to hear your name called for Outstanding Trainer. And I got to tell you, I have never been part of anything like that before, where I had to wait kind of Academy Award style for the name to be pulled out of the envelope. And I had some butterflies even before they got to our category. How about you, as you're sitting there and you're waiting to hear your name called for outstanding trainer? Were there some anxious moments for you?
You know what? I didn't think we could get the award. Cassie had done, like I say, he'd won two Breeders' Cups, so I thought if we won, they'd be rechecking the vote. I thought Karen, if she didn't win champion three-year-old, we might have burnt the place down. But other than that, I figured the best I could do was run second there.
Talk about her for a second. What makes her so great?
She's a pretty remarkable horse. I don't think I've trained another horse that's, you know, she broke her maiden going 4.5, and she also won a stake going 1.25 miles. There's probably not a lot of horses that can say they've done that. She's just been a real hard trying filly. We actually bought her at Fezzik Tipped in October, and I went there with my son, and I said, you know, Joe, I love this horse, but I think we paid too much for her. We gave like 45 for her. And she was the first crop sire of a horse called Society's Chairman, who I guess had some soundness issues, never got to the races until he was 4 or 5. And the mare, I think, was 19 when she had her. So, you know, there's some talk about horses after 15 not producing stakes winners. At least there's a lesser chance of that. So we took a bit of a gamble, but it certainly paid off. She's been just a wonder horse.
What did you like about her at the sales, Mike?
You know, it's kind of hard to say. She has good legs. She has some presence about her, but you kind of get that feeling when you see one you really like. It's like, man, I got to have that one. And when you come home from the sales, I was telling my wife and my son, you know, this is the most important day of the year for me because those are the days you sort of restock the shelves for next year. And those are your draft choices and the horses that, you know, will be your stars down the road, you hope.
Yeah, it's interesting how horses strike you like that. You know, it's like, I always tell people, it's like when you walk in a bar and there's like 400 girls, but there's always one that catches your eye for some reason. And maybe she's not the best looking or you know, dressed fancy or whatever, but, you know, you just kind of know. Is that how it is with you when you look at horses?
You know, it's kind of funny because I remember Nick Gonzalez, a buddy of mine, and he marked no on his catalog beside her. When I looked at him later in the day, I said, what's with that no? And he wouldn't tell me. But he had the brother, and the brother to this horse couldn't run. And that never bothers me, you know. There's a good old trainer up here called Loy Silver, and he would say, you know, mares had 4 or 5 foals, and they were no good. And he says, yes, man, he's Jamaican. He'd say, but I'm buying this one, man. And that's kind of the way it was with Karen. I didn't really care. Although she did have a greater stakes winner, the mare had a greater stakes winner earlier in her career. She hadn't had much lately. So I was happy to buy her. I couldn't understand why Cassie didn't buy her, but I think he had a half-sister buy Medallion Oro, you know, who's a much better stallion than Society's Chairman, and that horse was just ordinary, so he probably figured, well, how could an Ontario Sired one be any better? So I'm just guessing. That's probably why they passed on.
He probably had a no on his catalog, too.
Maybe, yeah.
Mike, when the owners got up to accept the award for champion three-year-old filly for Karen, they talked about how she ended up getting her name, and they had all of their children there with her, which I thought was really, really neat. And they talked about how each of the kids, they basically took each of their first initials, and
yes,
that became Karen, C-A-R-E-N.
Exactly. Well, the first horse that we bought, it was kind of weird. Like, I've never come across an owner like this before. You know how, like, some people have been to the races with their grandfather, their father, their mother, you know, all different types of ways being introduced to the game. But this guy come to me and he said, Mike, I want to buy a horse so that my kids can pat it. And I was like, well, I think you should go buy a pony and maybe your kids can ride it. He's got 3 young daughters, and, you know, to buy a racehorse just to come and pat it, I thought this guy's a little different. But the first horse we bought, he come to me after our sale, which is in September, and he said to me, we're going to buy a horse, but it can't run for claiming. I'm like, well, yeah, that sounds nice, but it's not easy to do. So I bought him an Ontario Sired horse by Philanthropist. And I figured, you know, we have a program here. There's a maiden allowance race, and there was a non-winners of 2 and a non-winners of 3 for Ontario Sired horses. So I figured, well, for a while, the horse maybe could be protected if it was good enough to stay at that level. But she was just kind of ordinary, and they called her Racin, which was Rob, Anna, Karma Faye, Elizabeth, and Natalia. So that's where the letters have come together. And Karen was a scramble of that. So it just worked out. kind of cool story.
Yeah, it's a pretty name for a champion filly too, I think.
Yeah, those one words are kind of cool.
Talking with trainer Mike DiPaolo here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike, how about your champion sprinter, No Holding Back Bear? You've had a long-time relationship with the owners, Bear Stables. Tell me a little bit about No Holding Back Bear and that relationship you have with those owners.
Well, I've trained for Dan Dion for a while now, and it's actually a bit of a sad story. No Holding Back Bear is now with Brian Lynch in Keeneland, and they're looking to get him started. We had a great go with him. Our track here is a synthetic track, and Mr. Dion said to me, you know, Brian's a little more central. You know, we had shipped him around a bit, and it's a little easier for Brian to do it where he's based. And he wanted to run him on the dirt a little more. So, unfortunately, we don't have him. But that's the way the game goes. And I still have a bunch of other horses for Danny. And, I'm a team player. I wish him well. And hopefully the horse goes on and does some good.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you bring that up, because that's one aspect of being a horse trainer that I think sometimes gets overlooked. And that situation occurs with trainers every single day, where they have horses that they do well with, they're taken away for whatever reason. You just outlined some valid reasons why he might be moved to a different trainer. And then I've always wondered, when a trainer has that happen to them, do they actually cheer for that horse, or do they say, okay, well, you know what, you're not with me anymore, I'm not going to cheer for you, and I hope you don't do well? But it sounds like you take the positive approach.
Well, like I say, you know, we need owners in this game, and you always want them to continue and do well. Because it's good for them. It's good for them. We might have some more horses show up in our barn. But yeah, obviously, you know, you'd hope you'd have been able to keep the horse. But I don't think you should be cheering against them. That's for sure.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense to burn bridges, because it's too tough to get clients nowadays. And
I've had people fire me before and come back. So it's just part of the game.
Yeah, Eddie Gregson used to say there's two kinds of trainers, those that have been fired and those that are going to get fired. So
that's right.
you kind of get used to it early on. It's always tough when you lose a horse, especially a nice horse, and you don't like to see him go, but you got to take the medicine sometimes.
Yeah, it's just, hockey players and baseball players get traded and stuff happens. I'm happy he showed up in my barn, because I guess I would have felt a little worse if I had purchased the horse, and I could have said, well, I could have given it to this owner or that owner. But that horse, as I said, just showed up in my barn one day, and we're $500,000 better in earnings and greatest stakes wins and a lot of fun and a trip to the Breeders' Cup. So it was a great experience.
Yeah,
Barrett's a good guy.
Talk about that trip to the Breeders' Cup, Mike. What was that like?
Well, I've been to California a bunch of times just as a fan. It's beautiful out there. You know, the mountains in the background, and looks like a pretty nice place. They looked after us real well. Unfortunately, my horse, we've had a little bit of a throat issue, but nothing serious. And that day, for whatever reason, Eurico Da Silva said he was making noise on post parade. So I don't know if he displaced his palate, if he got entrapped, whatever happened, but he wasn't really settled when they broke, and he just didn't run his race. And I'm hoping that we didn't operate or do anything to him over the winter, and I'm hoping he can come back and win some money for the Bear.
Some of these horses, when they race at Santa Anita, they get allergies, and there's pepper trees on the backside. I think it was F and X that broke out in hives.
Yeah.
And when I was a young guy working for Julio Canani, we had a horse that was stabled next to one of the pepper trees, broke out in hives, and it was just ridiculous. And Julio thought about it a little bit, and on his own, he moved him to another stall at another barn that didn't have a pepper tree, and the horse really blossomed. So I think it's one of those pitfalls. Sometimes going out to California is nice because of the weather, but you don't realize there's different pollens and things in the air out there, and the heat and all that. It can get to some horses sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, November in Toronto was fairly cool. You go there, I don't know. We shipped on top of the race, which is where we shipped him. You know, I thought we were going in the race in pretty good shape. But as you say, you know, who knows? Altitude, who knows?
Mike, I mentioned all of the winners that you've trained in your career, and there have been over 700. And then I mentioned all of the greatest stakes that you have on your resume. Where did this journey begin for Mike DiPaolo?
Well, my father, Joe DiPaolo, was an accountant, and he used to do accounting for Jerry Meyer and Bill Markle, and they were two prominent trainers here in Toronto. So as a young boy, I'd see the blood horse every week, and it'd be, you know, an exciting, cool color picture come on the cover, and I sort of got fascinated by that. My father owned horses back into, like, starting in 68, and I like to say I went to grade 13, and then I went to University of Woodbine. I've been here ever since.
Yeah, well, it certainly, you know, it certainly makes sense that you would continue on this path and be a horse trainer now, considering that background that you had. Was there ever a point where you thought about doing anything else, or was it always horse racing?
Yeah, probably every day I'd like to quit. I mean, it's just not an easy game. There's probably every trainer alive, it's like they'd like to be an agent at some point or another. But I don't know if this word's been, I don't know if it's a disease or a drug, but it's something, it's kind of like breathing. You just do it. I work 7 days a week. I rarely, very rarely take a day off. My wife drags me somewhere for a week. You know, in the winter, we went to Jamaica this year, but you're still on the phone at 4:30 talking to your guys. And when you have horses training, you can never really settle down and relax. It's not a 9-to-5 job. It's ongoing.
Yeah, it's 24 hours a day, 365 days a year.
A horse gets hurt, they don't want to hear old DePaul's laying on the beach in Mexico or somewhere. Yeah. It's not going to work that well.
Yeah, it's really funny, too, because owners always want to be trainers and trainers always want to be agents. It's really funny that you should mention that, because you see the agents, they don't do that much. They come out to the track. They have no expenses. They make 25% of what their jock makes. And you think, how long has this been going on? Why am I getting up at 4:30 every morning, busting my rear end, trying to get these horses to run when these guys are making all the dough? But you're right. You just cannot resist going to the barn. There's something about it that's fantastic.
Well, it's certainly nice when you got some young horses, too, that you're hoping with. You know, when you got a bunch of horses and you know where they're at, you know, even claiming horses, they're either going to be a jump up or a jump down or what you paid for them. But with a young horse, there's always some promise and some hope, and that's what I really like to do. I like buying young horses.
Mike, you mentioned the game being difficult, and a lot of trainers have come on this program and said it's a very tough game. Why is it so difficult?
Well, you're dealing with hopes. You're buying a horse for a guy, and you know, you go to the sale, you buy a bunch of horses. Sometimes the one you pay them the most for is the worst one. The one you pay the least for is the best one. And some guy will say, oh, you bought that one for your cousin. He's, you know, you like him more than me. It's so tough even from that standpoint. And we're sort of tested every day. Your work's tested. You're a painter. You paint a building, you get paid. In our job, if those horses don't produce, you really don't get paid. The day money, which has gotten very expensive, is basically just a wash. You got to win, and that makes it tough. Everybody else is trying to win, too.
And not just win. I've had many people that I've taken to the racetrack who are neophytes, and they'll ask me about different aspects of the game. And I'll tell them, just to get a horse to the races is an accomplishment. Forget about winning a race. Just to get to the starting gate is an accomplishment.
You better believe it. We have some new owners, and they'll say to me, well, my birthday's June 25th. Is there a chance we could run the horse that day? And you look at them like they got two heads. Like, what are you going to say? Who knows if the horse will even be breathing by then? Never mind running.
That cracks me up. It reminds me, I had a lady claim a horse for $10,000 at Santa Anita, and she says, this is in January, she says to me, is there any chance I could run this horse on St. Patrick's Day? I've got a bunch of people come to the track that day. And I just died laughing. Well, they put an extra on. It didn't go all week, and guess what day it went? St. Patrick's Day. And
you were stuck.
I was shocked, and my assistant put a shamrock on my blinkers, and the horse won the race. And I tell that had to be like a gazillion to one of that happening, you know, that we even still had the horse on St. Patrick's Day.
That's true, too, yeah.
Mike, what's the most bizarre request you've ever received from an owner?
Oh, man, I don't know. I've had some funny things happen to me in this business, but a bizarre request.
The birthday one's pretty bizarre.
The birthday one's pretty good. How about the funniest thing you've had happen to you? You said you had some funny things. What's some of the...
Oh, yeah. Well, a bunch of years ago, my wife was pregnant, and like the year of 92 was the first year I started to travel, so in the winter, because Woodbine pretty much runs. You can pretty much stay here most of the year. But now 92 runs along, and I said, geez, my wife's pregnant. I got to keep rolling. I better keep working. So I go to Philadelphia with the five or six worst horses ever assembled. And I had guys living with me. One guy said, you know, I don't really get along with my parents. Can I come and live with you? Just all you got to do is feed me. So we used to go to a place called Thank God It's Friday, TGIF. And we would go there and eat finger foods. Right? We watched the races, and I said, well, guys, we got to order something, right? Like, I don't drink, so I'm having a Coke. My buddies are having a Coke, and we're having, like, one night it's nachos, one night it's chicken wings, one night it's meatballs, whatever. So the bill comes, and it's about $8.70. So we've ordered nachos because we're big spenders. We're eating some nachos and three Cokes. The bill comes, $8.70, and I give the guy my credit card, and he comes back and says, sorry, your card's no good. And I'm like, oh, okay. So we start reaching. Three human beings. We haven't got $8.70. So I didn't even know what to do. I phoned my wife. She phoned Visa or MasterCard, whatever it was, and they put a higher limit on my card, and off we went. So there was a big story in the Toronto Sun one day about me, and they said, how are things? I said, well, things are going a little better now. I got a higher limit on my credit card.
Oh, that's a classic.
Yeah, Philadelphia was rough. We were there one day, too, and they thought we robbed the 7-Eleven. They had us on our knees, shotguns pointed at us.
What?
It was unbelievable. Yeah, this is a classic, too. We went. I had the guy staying with me, so I'm the cook. I'm making lunch. We're going to have burgers. So we go to 7-Eleven. I go to punch the ATM, and I'm waiting. The machine's taking a long time. I'm just trying to get 50 out of there. So I'm buying four hamburger buns. It's taking forever. Anyways, finally, the money comes out. And a buddy with me, I don't know, like he was in there doing something. I guess he was buying cigarettes. So I'm trying to back out of the 7-Eleven. All I got to do is go across the street, and I'm at the place where we live. And the guy's, there's a car, and he's kind of impeding me from backing up. So I said, guys, I don't know who this guy is, but he looks like a cop. Put your seatbelts on. We got our seatbelts on. He lets us go. As we're going to go through the intersection, a big white van comes screaming through, swings open the door. They point shotguns at us. And they're saying, driver, hand on the wheel. So I'm out moving, man. I got my seatbelt on. They grab the passenger door, whip the guy out. The guy in the back seat, they whip him out. So finally, I said, hey, man, I got my seatbelt on. I'm pointing down to my, you know, my seatbelt area to unlock it. So they let me out, hands on our knees, and we're looking. We don't have a clue. I said, man, this must be the best police force in the world because my buddy, maybe he stole something, and they called the cops, and here they are. So finally, as we're kneeling there with our hands behind our head, the one kid says to the cop, well, what do we do? He says, well, you guys are the prime suspect in a bank robbery up the street. Says, bank robbery? We're broke. We don't have any money. So these cops start looking in this bag of hamburger buns. There was like five guys looking at these hamburger buns. There was nothing to see. It was a brown paper bag with four buns in it. It's crazy. So the best part of the story is we find out later that the guy who robbed, they brought a teller by, and she looked at us and said, no, no, it's not them. And they started, when we were, you know, when we were waiting, they were going, well, the guy's got a blue shirt. Well, the guy said black. Close enough. Well, the guy's 6 feet. This guy's 6'2". Close enough. So eventually they found out the guy that robbed the bank, he was sitting in the bank looking at his mail, and he dropped his mail. So while he dropped his mail, he's robbing the bank. They traced him back to his house and caught the guy. It's crazy. Mm. So needless to say, no more trips to Philadelphia in the winter.
I was going to ask you if you've been back since.
We got lucky this year, actually. We won the Gallant Bob there, so it's the first time I won a race in Philly. We'll take it. It was a grade three with no holding back bear.
Yeah, they should have given you a police escort to the track.
Yeah.
After all the trouble they caused you there in Philadelphia. Mike DiPaolo, our special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Mike, you mentioned your wife being pregnant. How many kids do you have?
Well, that year we had twin boys. So my wife is a huge part of my stable. If it wasn't for her, I don't know, I'd probably be selling hot dogs somewhere. But she's an Attard. I married the boss's daughter. Joe Attard was the had brought over his brothers, Tino, Sid, Larry, and they're all successful trainers and horsemen here in Ontario.
So that's nice to have a wife that knows the game and understands it, huh?
Well, I'll tell you, I'd gone out with some girls before, and they say, well, it's Canada Day. Let's go away for the long weekend. I'm like, that's when we work. You know, we put the show on for other people that are on holidays. And as you know, holidays are racing days.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's the thing about being a horse trainer. It's 24/7, 365 days a week. As you said earlier, Mike, you can't go take a vacation at whim, because even when you're on vacation, you're really not on vacation.
Yeah, that's for sure. Your mind's still at the barn. It's kind of hard to really settle down and relax. Although we usually go with just like, you know, 10 horses to Gulfstream or something like that. So we go with some horses we want to lose and some we want to get ready. And it's a little different than having 45 or 50 at Woodbine. And you know, you got a bunch of owners coming to the barn every day and a lot more action.
What's your favorite U.S. racetrack to go to?
Well, I love the look at Keeneland. I just think Keeneland's a beautiful place. I love going to the sale there. Saratoga was cool, in and out. We had a good run there. We were third in the King's Bishop with no holding back there. But and Gulfstream, I mean, geez, how do you beat Gulfstream? I love Gulfstream. I don't know. I'll take any one of those three tracks. And, of course, Woodbine's home, and we spend a lot of time, most of the time here. It's a great place to race, and hopefully they'll let us hang around a little longer.
Yeah, what a tremendous facility Woodbine is, and how beautiful, and it's historic. There's so many things to like about it. And then you got the staff there. They treat you really good.
Yeah, I'm just pushing for pasta in the turf club. That's my only beef. I give it to them all the time. We've got a real big Italian community here, and I'm always telling them I got that roast beef. I've had enough roast beef for the rest of my life. I want a little pasta, so I'm going to work on that.
There you go.
They don't serve any pasta in the turf club?
Yeah, they do. They'll have some cold pasta and that, but Gulfstream has a good little goal where they'll have like a guy come in and just cook a little pasta right in front of you, you know, like in a little pan, fry it up a little, and boom, off you go.
Yeah, good stuff. Mike DiPaolo with us here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Stay with us. We're going to get to a short break. We'll come back and continue our visit in the second half of the show. This is indeed Trainer Talk, and it is presented by Fasig Tipton.
Nominate your yearlings now to the Fasig Tipton Summer Selected Yearling Sales. These sales are the top three yearling sales in North America by rate of return. The July sale in Lexington, Kentucky, July 10th and 11th. The Saratoga sale in Saratoga Springs, New York, August 7th and 8th. And the New York Bred sale in Saratoga Springs, New York, August 12th and 13th. Selected sales, superior results. Nominate today at FasigTipton.com.
Bloom Racing.
Majestic City could also still do it, and here he comes.
Majestic City running a big one.
Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Soul Driver the leader, though. Soul Driver in front.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now. Get in on the action at BloomRacing.com.
It all started with a dream. A dream to be the best. To breed the best. To race the best. And to stand the best. Windstar Farm. Dedicated to the dream.
This is Trainer Talk on HRRN, presented by Fasig Tipton.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on HRRN. Mike Penna, Jude Feld, that's Baron and Pontiff, together once again in our Jimmy John's of Lexington broadcast studios. Enjoying our visit with trainer Mike DiPaolo, who is based in Canada. He's a native of Toronto, and boy, has he had just a remarkable career and some great stories in the first half of the show. If you did miss any portion of it, head back to our website, horseracingradio.net. Check out the podcast at your leisure. You can also do that on iTunes by searching Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes, and you can listen to this show and all of our Trainer Talk programs right there each and every time that we're on the air. And JT, really fun stuff in the first half of the show, and excited to see what comes up in the next 25 minutes or so.
No, I can't wait. Let's get to it.
I want more. Yeah. Shut up, Baron. Back to Mike DiPaolo. And Mike, you referenced in the first half of the show that you had twin boys. You also have a daughter who is not necessarily involved in the sport, but your boys are. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I have a son, Joseph. He's got his assistant trainer's license. And my other son, Mike, is he used to hot walk a little for us, but he's got allergies. So he's still at school. He's got a couple degrees, and I keep bugging him to come in and walk. But he gives me the sneezing stories, and he gets a pass. But they're good kids. No complaints so far. Joey's actually runs Karen. I've got my sister-in-law works for me also, Michelle Armada. Armadas are a big racing family here, so a lot of connections to keep us busy.
Yeah, it has to be kind of neat to have your whole family involved.
Yeah, I guess that's about all we talk about. I've had some relatives come over and say, well, they're looking to see a magazine. I've got like a horse magazine or a sales book. And I don't know. I guess I kind of live it and sleep it, I guess.
Yeah, it's kind of a lifestyle, isn't it? It's not just your job, but it's a way of living, and everything revolves around the track.
Yeah, the racetrack's kind of more your life than your regular life, really. With the amount of hours you spend here and time spent, it is really a lifestyle.
Mike, you took out your trainer's license at the age of 22. I guess that was back around 1986. Your first win came shortly after that in April of 1987. Take me back to that day and your first winner.
Yeah, the first year we didn't win a race, and it's kind of humbling when you go back and look at your stats, but I think the first, I was working for my father-in-law, Joe Attard, and when I had my license, the first horse I ran, I think they claimed on me. So I had finally got my license in May, and I got my stalls in June. And they claimed the horse off me. It was a four-year-old maiden, and here I was. I had two stalls and no horses. So my father had a two-year-old. We shipped a two-year-old in, and then we claimed another horse. And I had one client at the time, and I won a race at Greenwood. It was like a classic. It was a maiden four-year-old for 5,000 claimants. So it was a good way to start. You could only go up from there.
Well, that's how you got to start. I mean, there's so few people that get to have a stakes winner right off the bat. I mean, it's almost unheard of. It's getting nowadays with all these assistants that are so talented, it happens to them more often. But in the old days, that never happened.
No, and I guess in one way, I was never anybody's assistant, which I wouldn't really recommend doing it that way. I watch Roger Atfield and you know, the guys that I work for, and you pick up your own style. And I guess I've been a little lucky. I've been able to buy a decent horse, and that's kind of what saved me, I think.
Mike, who are some of the best trainers that you've ever seen?
Well, I mean, here in Toronto, Roger Atfield, he's won the plate like 8 times, I think. He's tied for the record. And we have a lot of fun with these guys. Doyle's the best. You'll say to Atfield, okay, you win the plate 8 times. What'd you do the other years? Like 30 or 40 years now. So that's kind of cool. But, you know, going to Florida, you see guys like Alan Jerkins. That was a cool thing about going to Florida. You see guys like Babe Ruth walking around. One day I remember looking, I said, there's an older guy there. I wonder who that is. And they said that was Billy Turner. I said, man, sure, he had Seattle Sleuth. He was a great guy. And it's kind of cool. You see, it's like, you know, walking around seeing Joe Lewis, people like that at Gulfstream. Just a great spot to be. And you try to pick stuff up from everybody, hot walkers, grooms, blacksmiths. Jerry Meyer was a help. And Bill Markle was probably my inspiration, the guy to train deputy minister.
What made Bill so good?
You know what? Bill was kind of different. He had the public relations skills, and he was a good hustler. And he was Jerry Meyer's bookkeeper at one point, which was kind of funny because my father was Bill's accountant. I never did quite understand that story. But Bill was able to buy a good horse, and I said, geez, if Bill can do it, and he was sort of, I don't want to say he was afraid of horses, but he was kind of cautious around horses. And he wasn't the most accomplished horseman himself, but all in all, he got it done, and he set a couple records here. I think he won 2 Sovereign Awards back-to-back. And he had a horse called Froth King that made $1 million and change, which was, you know, remarkable back in the day. And he had Deputy Minister, who I think he won 5 races in a row with him. And I sort of thought that if he could do it, I should give it a try.
It's always good to have somebody like that to look up to and give you some confidence. Did you ever go to him when you were, you know, around him and say, I got a problem with this horse, what do you think?
I didn't go to him, but I did go to J.C. Meyer and my father-in-law on some things. But I can tell you a great first day story about Bill Markle. This is a classic. First day on the job, I'm 18 years old, fresh out of high school. I'm a city boy. I might have walked a horse around very, very little. So now I've been hot walking maybe a couple days. And he says, go over, you know, everybody's got nicknames. Go over to the paddock with, this guy's name was Gurney. Go over to the paddock with Gurney and walk this horse, you know. So I'm going over the paddock. So Gurney didn't think this horse had a chance. So he gave it to another more experienced hot walker. Give him $20, let him run the horse. The horse gets to the paddock, and the horse needs to wear a tongue tie. Now, poor Bill, he wasn't that great at putting on a tongue tie. So he says to me, go grab Blinky. It was one of his other grooms who was in the grandstand. So I grab Blinky. Blinky comes in, puts the tongue tie on. The groom, or the hot walker that run the horse, he got mad. So Marco and him got in a fight. He quit. So here I am leading this horse out. It's my first day on the job. And we're leading him to the races and back to the barn after the races. So I said, wow, this was kind of baptism by fire here.
Did he do any good?
I didn't run any good. The groom was right. He gave the guy 20.
He stayed back at the barn and had a beer.
Yeah, exactly.
Mike DiPaolo on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton on HRRN. Mike, tell me about a horse that maybe surprised you. Maybe you didn't think there was a lot of talent there, and all of a sudden you got them to the races, and boom, they turned out to be pretty darn good.
Probably one of the best horses I ever trained was a horse called Shillelagh Slew. He was champion 3-year-old. He was a big, leggy, good-looking horse. And it wasn't really that it was a surprise, but I come back from Gulfstream, and my wife had him here. And we had bought a couple horses that year for the same client. We got outbid on the horse that ended up winning the plate. And we went to Keeneland and bought 2, one for 60 and Shillelagh for 40. Of course, the one for 60 we sent to Ocala and give him all the breaks, and the one we bought for 40 we just left here. But when I come back, and he was up to about 3/8 of a mile, he went 35 and change with the rider swinging off him. I said, Joe, who's that? He said, that's Chief Seattle Colt. I said, wow. And he turned out to be, you know, he's pretty much maybe the best horse I ever trained, just because he had ankles, knees, hocks, throat. He was just a real good horse.
It's always
he actually beat the horse to win the plate later on, so it was kind of a little vindication there.
Yeah, it's always nice when a horse surprises you like that, especially horses that have adversity, horses that really try even though maybe they don't have the best parts.
We did have another horse, too, a horse called Crazy Ruckus. He was the last crop of Bold Ruckus. He was kind of a lazy, big, fat guy, and he always blew. He didn't have the best throat in the world. So we're working him and working him and working him. And I said, man, I better run him because, you know, this one was going to say, what's going on? Anyways, he went his first start and paid like $30. And he went on and made $1,000,001, which was really cool.
Yeah, that's great.
But initially in his first bit of training, he didn't show a lot. And the owner kept asking me, how's that horse doing? Because he was out of a stakes winning mare. And by Bold Ruckus, who was our leading sire at the time, he was a surprise. We'd hoped he'd been a good horse, but... And he was a character. You had to put a blindfold on him to get him in the gate. And old-time trainer said to me, you better get rid of that horse. He don't want to go in the gate. He's no good. Well, I'll tell you one thing. He was the quickest one out of there. He couldn't wait to get out of there. He made a million one that way.
Didn't want to go in, but wanted to get out. Well, you have a horse that you feel like maybe people don't know what a great training job you did, but you do. Is there a horse like that in your past?
Well, it's kind of funny. That horse, Crazy Ruckus, we win maybe five in a row with him. And at the time I thought, you know, this is pretty cool. We really accomplished something here. But the racing game's kind of funny. I don't know that it matters, at least here in Toronto, unless somebody recommends you, like somebody from a farm or somebody from Ocala. It seemed like didn't matter how good you did. You didn't really pick up any new clients or more stalls or more owners. It was just basically referrals. You know, somebody say, yeah, that guy's okay. He's going to give you a fair shake. And that was a little disappointing. You know, you could run a horse. I remember one year we had like maybe 40 starts and I had 10 wins and I don't know if we had 10 seconds or 5 thirds, something ridiculous. And, you know, you're running a horse once a week. Even if he wins, nobody even really realizes it.
Mike, let me take you back to December 4th, 1995. That was a day that you saddled three horses. You won with all three. You had Formal Notice, who paid $43 to win. You had Mythical Zira, who paid $59.80 to win. And then you came back in the 10th race with Quest for Lisa, who paid $4.50. Obviously, you remember that day vividly. Tell me about that day.
Well, it's kind of funny because Quest for Lisa, I thought, was a cinch, and she barely won. And I think the other horse, a Mythical Zira, she was okay. But I want to say that the first horse we ran, what was his name again?
Formal Notice.
Formal Notice. I think we had just purchased that horse. And the guy that trained him, I didn't think he was all that sharp. And I took an exercise boy to get on him, and the horse ran off with him 2 miles. I said, you know what, we'll take him. And, I forget it. I think he had popped the curb. Something funny. Anyways. That set of owners, they were good guys, two brothers, and the one guy wanted to kill me because he was the saddest looking owner in the winner's circle because the horse paid a lot of money and he didn't bet.
No.
It was one of those surprise things, but that worked.
Well, it sounds like somebody made a parlay because two long shots and then the last horse paid $4.
Yeah, that one we loved and it barely got up there. Just one.
Yeah, just amazing. Unreal. Mike DiPaolo with us here on Trainer Talk. It's all presented by Fasig Tipton. If you miss any portion, head to our website, horseracingradio.net, and check out the podcast of this show and all of our Trainer Talk shows. Mike, what's the most rewarding thing about being a horse trainer?
Well, I mean, I guess we made $3 million in Toronto and some money in the States. So I don't know, $400. I mean, the money doesn't really agree with me. It doesn't mean anything to me. I always tell my wife, as long as I got enough money for a veal sandwich and a racing form, I'm okay. But, I mean, it's my big kick is seeing young horses turn out. That you've gone and bought a horse and said, this is my opinion, that this is a good one and this horse is going to be okay. When they turn out, it's very gratifying to me. That claiming races to me, you know, it's part of the game. And you win a race here and there, that doesn't really do much for me. But having a good horse that you bought turn out just fantastic.
As you've gotten along in your career, do you find that the claiming game doesn't hold the same appeal as it used to?
Well, in our circuit here, they've we've got a lot of Ontario sired races, and it's kind of hurt the claiming game a bit. And also back in the day, we had guys like Gord Huntley. Gord would go by a field of horses, and there'd be one or two stars in there, and it was kind of like a lottery. He'd run a good one and then two or three bad ones, and, you know, you'd be able to catch the odd good one. And Cassie back in the day, when he had Mockingbird, you know, horses that didn't sell, those horses were sort of up for sale, you know, through the claiming ranks. They'd run them where they could win, and they'd win them and get claimed and a way of moving them on. But the claiming game here, I think, is pretty tough. Although Kevin Attard's had a pretty good go the last few years doing it. I we've had some good horses we've claimed turn out, but I much prefer the yearlings.
Mike, you mentioned having enough money for a veal sandwich and a racing form. You took me back to my childhood. I also grew up in an Italian household, and I used to be addicted to veal sandwiches. Are they your favorite?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. When I come back from the United States, I'm looking for a veal sandwich because it doesn't. We have a lot of hot tables here. You can go in and get some pasta, sausage, veal, meatball, whatever. Doesn't seem to exist in Florida as much.
No.
And I certainly miss it. We're looking for Swiss Chalet and Harvey's when we get home and a veal.
I'm going to have to check that out when we come back up for Queen's Plate. We'll have to go there.
Sounds good. Anytime.
Mike, do trainers have go-to jockeys?
I would say yes. Sometimes you have a relationship with an agent that you kind of ride his guy. And Neil Wilson's ridden, who's Jesse Campbell's agent, has ridden a bunch of horses for me over the years, you know, his jocks. And I had Dino Luciani a bunch of years ago. He won a lot of stakes for me. He wasn't a real, you know, he wasn't a top 1, 2, 3 guy. But you kind of like to build a rapport with a guy, and, you know, the jock knows what you're looking for. You know what kind of ride you're going to get. But Louis Contreras won, you know, 2 legs of the Triple Crown for me, so we like to ride him a little. And De Silva's ridden a bunch. Yeah, there's 4 or 5 guys I ride pretty steady.
It really helps when you have a guy that's willing to work with you and get on some horses and that type of thing. Do you use a lot of riders when you breeze horses in the morning?
We have a lot of our exercise boys breeze the horses, but we certainly do mix it up with the riders. So we'll use a combination. You got a lot of horses, no way of getting, you know, it's hard to get 4 or 5 top riders at the same time. It's next to impossible. But we try to use the jocks when we can.
Mike, you told some great stories in the first half of the show, and I asked you about some of the more outrageous instructions or requests that you've gotten from owners, and some of the best stories we've heard from trainers on this program involve jockeys. And Jude would be the first one to tell you that, you know, that's always a interesting gamble when you do all the work with a horse and then you give a leg up to a jockey and things can go wrong in a heartbeat and kind of wipe out all the work you did. How about any stories involving riders and some of the crazy things that have happened over the years?
Well, I remember I had a filly and I was going to run her in an allowance race, and the jock said, "The allowance?" I said, "Yeah, we're going to give her a shot, see what happens." So he's riding her in the middle of the race. He gives her a little tap. She took off so fast, she banged the horse beside her, and he got disqualified. And it was kind of, I kind of thought the horse was better than the jock thought. And it's kind of funny because the next time she run, she went again, and he was sitting in the jock's room watching because he got dazed. He didn't expect her to take off like that when he gave her a smack. She turned out to be a good filly. A filly called Kissed by a Prince. She made like 400 and change.
Yeah.
So the same jock had a girlfriend. We had this one horse. The horse had a bit of a crack heel. And we're putting some. I made the mistake of putting a crack heel ointment on right in front of the jock, and the horse kind of twisted and bobbled, and because it's a little painful. So he looked at me and he gave me some talk. I said, "Look, let your girlfriend get on it." Tammy Frost was his girlfriend at the time, and she breezed the horse. Horse working 34, 35, and win next week. And I let her ride the horse. It's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Shouldn't let the jocks look down. Just let them look up.
Yeah, a lot of them have that policy themselves. They don't want to look down.
Yeah.
That's a great – I love that
jocks,
one.
I mean, that's the toughest job going. I mean, you know, number one, they have to struggle with the weight. I wouldn't be able to eat any veal sandwiches if I was a jock, that's for sure. But it's a tough thing. Not too many jobs you have an ambulance following you around when you go to work, right?
Yeah.
So I never yell and scream at the jocks. Stuff happens as soon as the gate opens. You tell them to take them back. They're in front. Same, you know. So the jocks certainly earn every penny they get.
Yeah, it's always different, too, when you're watching from the stands and you're not actually involved in the three dimensions of the race. You know, it's easy for us to knock from the outside. That's one thing I've learned since I retired from training and went to the journalism side. When you're watching the race, you know, you say, why is that guy doing that? But he's in the middle of it and you're not. So you always have to remember that.
Yeah, it's certainly easy to be a Monday morning quarterback, that's for sure. You know, if I fall off, someone will be the bar stool. So, when I don't drink, so I'll be really, you know, if I do something stupid, it's just because I'm stupid. Those guys, they've got a tough job. Tough, though. I respect them. I really do.
Mike, if you weren't training horses, what else do you think you might be doing?
Well, I think I'd really love to be a bloodstock agent, but and I'm sort of a bloodstock agent through training. You know, it's the only way I could kind of do it. Buy my own horses and then train them. But the bloodstock agent's a great thing. I buy a horse and I tell that owner, man, I bought you a nice horse. I said, your trainer screwed him up. Well, I bought him. He was great.
Why a bloodstock agent? What is it about that that attracts you to that profession?
Takes over at some point. Maybe we can do a little of that, or maybe even do it for myself.
Yeah, why would you want to be a bloodstock agent? What is it about that job in particular?
Well, again, I really get a kick on that discovery thing, like finding a diamond in the rough. All my life I've had to buy horses that didn't have a ton of pedigree, because I'm always looking for the athlete. If you buy good legs and you buy pedigree, you can't, you know, I generally couldn't afford them. So I had to buy a lesser type pedigree with some legs. I'm kind of proud to say we had the first winner that Silver Deputy ever had. And he was the first winner and first Colt Stakes winner. I think I give $6,200 for him, which was, you know, kind of cool. That stud started here in Toronto and just took off. I think he stood for $2,500 and he went up to maybe $125 at one point.
When you go look at a horse at a sale, are there certain traits and certain boxes that horse absolutely has to check before you even consider going forward and purchasing the horse?
Well, you know, sometimes you got to give and take too. You know, you'd love to walk up to a horse and just say, man, I love this horse. And sometimes you do. But, you know, you got all different orders. Guy's looking to buy a horse for $30,000. Somebody's looking to spend a little more. So sometimes you're a little more forgiving and different areas, but I think you try to stay away from those horses that are back at the knee. That's kind of a pretty big fault. Yeah, we'd like to see a horse with a good hip, an athletic kind of walk. And again, you got to have that feeling to say, yeah, I really kind of like this one. So it's a little bit of a package.
There are going to be people listening, Mike, that hear you say back at the knee, and they're going to be like, what on earth is that? What is he talking about? Explain that for a minute, and why is that? Why can that be such a detriment?
Well, that's a confirmation fault. When you're looking at a horse, it's kind of hard to see. When you're looking at the horse, you know, from the side, sometimes you'll see pictures of a horse striding out, and you'll see that the knee is kind of bent backwards. Makes it very horses on the horse's knee, very hard on the tendons, ligaments, and shin. And it's probably the most serious fault that there is. And on our track up here, also, you need a good set of hocks on the back. I guess it sounds funny when you say you can't say back hocks, but I'm saying if people aren't familiar with where the hocks are, it's the back leg. It's kind of like the back knee. It's the area where they get that push from. And our track's synthetic. I think it's pretty important to have a real good hind end on our racetrack up here at Woodbine. And it's important anywhere, but I think it's especially important, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. So there is a difference in the type of horse you're looking for to race on a synthetic surface as opposed to, say, a traditional dirt surface.
I'll tell you, I've been trying to figure out a synthetic foot, and they seem to come in all kinds of different varieties. You know, you know how you see a horse with a big, big flat foot, you say, yeah, that's a turf foot, or you see maybe a clubby-footed horse or a sort of misshapen, you say that horse will do well in the mud. There doesn't seem to be one for Paul, at least I haven't found it. I guess if I found it, I wouldn't tell you anyways, maybe.
Yeah, keep that information for yourself.
Yeah.
Is there truth to that turf foot, that big, wide type of foot? Is that true?
You know, I've heard different opinions about that. I've also heard it's very important to be quite wide at the heel. So I've tried to look, you know, when we're looking for a turf horse, look for a horse with a nice big toe or a nice sort of a flatter foot or a big heel. But then you see horses that have, you know, ugly kind of feet that just run across the grass like a deer. So I think it's just in their makeup, how much they try. And you know, those big flat turf horses, they never really like to slop that much, though, usually.
Yeah, that's true. Do you like turf racing as opposed to dirt, or do you have a preference?
For some weird reason, the turf racing seems to have the most prestige. Every owner wants to run on the grass, and you'll get an owner drop a horse, run on the grass, where if you ask them to drop that horse on the dirt or the poly, they look at you like you had three heads. But to have an opportunity to run on the grass, people think it's a big deal for some reason. I don't know if you guys have found that, but that's what I've noticed.
Yeah. He's trainer Mike DiPaolo. He is with us on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. Mike, we are inside of 2 minutes, coming into the final 16th of a mile on this edition of the program. So let me end by asking you to kind of tell our listeners something that they might not know about Mike DiPaolo, maybe other interests, hobbies, things that you enjoy doing outside of racing.
Yeah, there wouldn't be a lot. Well, eating would be right up there. Nice Italian restaurant really works for me. I don't know. I mean, I think that I really try. That's all I can tell you. I give them the best effort I can. And, my father would tell me, if you're going to sweep the shed or do whatever, rake the shed, do the best you can. So I've always tried to do that. And it sometimes drives you crazy because there's always a spot you miss. But that's kind of the way I've tried to do things. And so far we still have a job and we're still kicking. So can't complain.
He's Mike DiPaolo. He is our guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. Mike, can't tell you how much we've enjoyed this hour. Been a great visit. All the best moving forward, and we'll look forward to seeing you when we get there for Queen's Plate later this year.
Perfect, guys. We'll be happy to see you. Take you out for some lunch or dinner or something.
We're in. Veal sandwich.
Perfect.
Good luck. Mike DiPaolo, boy. Fun stuff. Great stories. Head back to our website, horseracingradio.net, if you missed any portion, and enjoy it. That was fun.
Yeah, fantastic show.
Yeah, good stuff. All right, our thanks to Mike DiPaolo. Our thanks to our producer, Lee Della Pina, here in our Jimmy Johns of Lexington studios. For the Pontiff of the Pick Four, Jude Feld, I'm Mike Pena. We'll talk to you next time on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton.